Ari Rosenbaum here with another fun-filled episode of that 401k podcast. This week's topic, we're going to talk about retirement plan catastrophes that should be avoided. We always know that people out there know about my favorite disaster movies and all that stuff, and I see a lot of catastrophes, but of course, let's go to better news. Go to that 401ksite.com for further information on all our live events. Arlington, Texas is just 2 weeks away, May the 3rd, Friday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Special guest Dave Valley, who is the Rangers TV voice, I believe, former Ranger, former Mariner. Got a good crowd so far, people signing up. We always get that mad rush the week of, but we have a decent crowd, better than some of the other events that I had in 2021, which, after COVID, that wasn't a lot of fun in terms of getting people to show up. But I ran three events in September 2021, which were making up the 2020 dates. Houston actually had a good crowd, but some of the other ones, St. Louis and Minnesota, just did not have great crowds. But we got a good crowd for Texas. We're getting a good crowd for New York City, the Bronx, New York. I always have to say the Bronx because it's not Bronx, it's the Bronx. Yankee Stadium, Friday, June the 7th. Special guest, Jim Leyritz, 1996 World Series hero. Well known for that home run in Game 4 of the 96 World Series. Of course, that warrengatesite.com, $100 to attend. If you have a couple of people from your firm that want to show up, we do a better job with that. Email me, and we could talk on what we can do to bring more people to these events. I think that's what we're going to do for this. These are the events for 2024. Is that what year we're in? 2025, we'll probably run two to three events. And I'm thinking Anaheim, I'm thinking Washington, D.C. We'll see what happens. As I've said and been very, very transparent, so much of the venues, the pricing of the rental of the venue determines everything. So there are a lot of stadiums out there. I'd love to run an event. My favorite ballpark is Fenway Park, but when I went to them about 5 years ago, it was a $25,000 minimum food purchase, and that's a problem when my events don't cost $25,000. And San Francisco is really expensive, and San Diego is really expensive. San Francisco, I tried Oracle Park, I tried Levi Stadium in Santa Clara. That really didn't work out. Petco Park was just too much. Yankee Stadium is really the I don't know how we're doing it, but we're doing it, Yankee Stadium, and that will be the most expensive venue that we've ever run. Previous to that, the funniest joke is the most expensive venue I've ever run is the worst venue I've ever run, which was Tropicana Field. We had some nice events, Wade Boggs back-to-back. I tried doing a plan sponsor event that, didn't really attract what I thought I could get. But it was a good event for both days, and Wade Boggs was the guest for both days, which was a lot of fun. But let's go to the topic at hand. Lived a while, seen a lot of epic disasters and catastrophes in my lifetime. I'm still shocked sometimes of some of the things. I think the first big shock was when I was 13 years old and the Challenger went down, and September 11th, and, someone with roots in Israel, October the 7th is certainly on the list. Forget about those catastrophes where people lose lives. And those are, certainly tragedies. And I don't want to compare it to, catastrophes in retirement plans, because I've dealt with a lot of catastrophes over the years with retirement plans. Nobody died yet. So that is certainly a difference. But there are certain catastrophes that really threaten the tax qualification of a plan. And, retirement plans have to abide by the Internal Revenue Code. If not, they lose their tax qualification. And right now I'm working with this accountant on these plans that he has for his clients. And these plans are on the verge of disqualification. Why are they on the verge of disqualification? Because, we'll talk about the control group rules, but You know, they refuse to correct these problems, and they're playing games and whatnot. And plan disqualification is the most severe punishment that the IRS can slap on a retirement plan. It's a catastrophic failure. And what happens is people have immediate income for their retirement savings. Plan sponsor loses the tax deductions. And, you know, they will get they lose the tax deductions, but then they will be able to get a tax deduction when the participant is taxed, which doesn't make any sense, but that's how it is. It really should be a severe penalty. But, you know, certain errors will do that. Most errors will not. Speaking about errors that could threaten disqualification, I was referred to by an advisor. Still haven't heard back from the client, where they don't have their plan documents. TPA, you know, it's always you know, I wouldn't say it's inaccurate, but you know, you always have the dog ate my homework excuse for kids, but for a lot of plan sponsors, and it's not really. It's not untruthful, but you know, you hear the TPA died, and TPA died, and their plan documents missing, and that's a problem because every qualified plan in the Internal Revenue Code needs to be written. It's got to be updated, ancillary amendments, restatements every 6 years, and you know, when I worked for a TPA. You know, doing these amendments and restatements was always a pain in the rear end, not for doing the work, because, you know, a lot of it's brain dead work, especially those ancillary amendments, but restating a document, what was the most annoying part? Not doing the work, dealing with the clients who, you know, I felt like Monty Hall on Let's Make a Deal. I know Wayne Brady's probably hosted the show longer, but it still will always be Monty Hall to me. And, you know, people always think they can just, you know, play games, and they think you're at the Shuk in Jerusalem, and you're just trying to make deals and chiseling people. And, you know, there are clients out there, if they chisel the TPA out of $250 or $500, then that's their win for the week. That's one of my nitpicks. I don't like to chisel people. I don't like, you know, I have people that I deal with. And I'll go to my mechanic. I had a discussion with Ralph recently about that. The idea that, you know, Ralph tells me the price of the car, the fix of the car. I just had a $60,000 mile check on my car. If he tells me it's $1,000, I don't try to, you know, nickel and dime him for $950. But, you know, we would have to restate the plan document. It would have, you know, obviously complying with the law. Plan documents had to, which is always funny because it has to comply with the previous law. Because Secure and Secure 2.0, that's not part of, I don't think it's part of the next restatement. It's part of the restate, it's part of the law changes beforehand. And it's annoying the plan sponsors have to do that. But, you know, the running joke is if plan sponsors have to do that, then it, you know, makes money for us ERISA attorneys and TPAs and all that stuff. And of course, plan sponsor doesn't have an amendment restatement. They can fix it, voluntary compliance. Of course, a big problem is they have a missing document. IRS takes position if you have a missing document, missing restatement, whatever it is, it's treated as if you didn't do it. So, you know, the dog ate your restatement, that's not going to fly with the IRS. So it's important for when the IRS tells you when it's time to amend and restate, you should get it done. Next, the controlled and affiliate service group rules, and this is why I'm running into trouble with this CPA, with his clients. They have glaring control group issues. You know, a guy owns, or he had, you know, familial relations, which gets attributed to them. Father and son, doctors, their plans have to get aggregated when they own 100% of each company. You know, the controlled and affiliated service group rules were much needed, I think. Everybody's clever. It's all about trying to deprive coverage of people, employees, and, you know, they, if you didn't have control group rules, then people would just set up these dummy corporations to employ people and not provide retirement plan benefits, and the highly compensated employees would have DB plans of their own. So it's to close loopholes. And, you know, when you have a control group or affiliated service group, which could be as little as 10% affiliate service group rules, you're, you know, allowing for coverage for employees to get retirement plan coverage. And I think it's really, really important. There are stock attribution rules that catch people. The CPA didn't know, again, the attribution rules between father and son. It's pretty clear. I got into a fight with another attorney. CPA got me on a call. And, of course, dealing with an attorney for a client, the guy was not an ERISA attorney, and he was just nasty as hell. Because, you know, attorneys who are not ERISA attorneys are really impossible to deal with at times because they think they know what the rules are. And I was talking about the stock attribution rules between husband and wife and the exceptions. And if a husband and wife work in each other's company, that doesn't fit that exception. And therefore, it's a control group. And he's like, oh, what's your pedigree? I'm like, I'm not a dog. I said, you know, I wasn't going to list every TPA I ever worked with and blah, 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 blah. I said, I have 25 years experience. And of course, he then later realized that I was correct. We do have these rules. And, you know, it's affiliate service group rules are a little more difficult to understand than the control group rules because it's more fact sensitive. Control group, the numbers are the numbers. 80% or more, 5 or less, those are kind of simple rules. Attribution between, you know, father and child, the 21 rule, if the child is over the age of 21, all that kind of stuff, it all fits together. It all makes sense. Affiliate service group, you know, it's not so clear-cut. It's all facts and circumstances. And it's a mess. Because it's a mess, when the previous folks did it incorrectly and you have a coverage issue because you failed to cover other employees, because, you know, in control group, affiliate service group rules, you're treated as one employer, and that could certainly be a problem. And, you know, it's a catastrophic result when you fail to cover employees because there's going to be corrective contributions that are going to be made. And, you know, if it's a DB plan, defined benefit plan, oh, God, who knows what those numbers could look like. Next on the hit list, theft by plan fiduciaries and plan providers. It doesn't happen often, but again, I know two folks. I believe the second guy is now also in a halfway house, stealing millions of dollars from retirement plans. Not a good idea, but it's a catastrophic error. It happens. But, you know, one way to fix it is having an ERISA bond in place. You know, the problem with the bond sometimes is the bond limit, which is $500,000 per plan official per plan, is that the bond will never cover with the theft. So when Bernie Madoff walked away with $3 million as part of a Ponzi scheme for a client, they didn't have an ERISA bond. Even if they did, they'd still be out $2.5 million. Now, in that case, what happened was there were enough clawbacks that they were made whole, which I always have to say. And of course, if a plan sponsor doesn't have a ERISA bond, they are a target for an audit. That is a, you know, red flag. That's a flare to the DOL and or the IRS that there's a problem with the plan and that maybe they should look for it. So it's an error that really brings up a lot of audits. And a lot of audits, you know, listen, pays my bills, but you want plan sponsors to be in a situation where they don't have to go through something like that. And, you know, it's just plan sponsors need to realize ERISA bonds require fiduciary liability insurance is not. It's recommended. And, of course, there's always that problem sometimes where the plan sponsor gets a bonds and it's a crime policy and not an ERISA bond and whatnot. Next, incorrect compliance tests. You know, obviously compliance testing is done to make sure that plans don't discriminate in favor of highly compensated employees. And The problem with that, in my mind, I don't think the fairness of the ADP test, where, you know, in my opinion, somebody making $155,000 isn't exactly highly compensated if they live in New York, LA, Boston, San Fran. That's one aspect of it. And the other aspect is that the 2%, you know, when you highly compensated employees can't really basically defer more than 2% than what non-highlies. And, I don't find that to be discrimination. People who make more money can defer a lot more. That's just the nature that I feel. Obviously, if we went to a universal availability requirement, like we have with 403Bs, that would fix the problem. But of course, then we would no longer have the need for safe harbor contributions, and that would obviously cost participants. So there's the ADP, ACP coverage, top-heavy, all these compliance testing, and, you know, there are a lot of times there are a lot of screw-ups. I had a union that spun off from another union. The union that they spun off from was a safe harbor plan. The union spun out. They were not going to have a safe harbor plan. Well, you know, one of these really good mutual fund companies, TPA, they didn't do the compliance testing because they assumed that the plan was safe harbor when it was not. And, of course, their excuse was you didn't pay for it, so no big deal. Which reminds me of one of my funny beer drinking drinking stories. I was at an event. It was a college Republican event, New York State, and it was at SUNY Albany, which is, I think, State University of New York at Albany or Albany State University. I have no idea what it is. It's called the University of Albany. I'm sorry now. And we were staying at somebody's house and, you know, sleeping bags on the floor, and some guy the whole night drank too much and was thrown up all night. And then in the morning, he's trying to run to the bathroom and he just throws up on the floor right near us. And his answer was, "Sorry, guys, but it was only water," because he couldn't keep his water down. That is no solace. So telling me you screwed up and you treated the plan as safe harbor and it's not, and saying, "Well, you didn't charge me for the compliance testing," that's not an answer. That's not an excuse. That still doesn't work. And thankfully, they passed the ADP and ACP test. That was great. So we avoided that problem. And they did pay for the testing, which, again, it was really, really bad. And then the problem with sometimes with compliance testing, sometimes they're done incorrectly. So, you know, there happens when, you know, they should be coded as an HC and they're not. Attribution rules with HC determination, people don't figure that one out too. I've seen that done on the top heavy test. Law firm, you know, when the guy's the named partner, it's a clue that their spouse and their daughter should be key employees too. Of course, these corrections on the a lot of the compliance testing can be done through voluntary compliance. The problem with ADP and ACP is if you're out of time and it's past another year, you lose the flexibility of, you know, offering ADP refunds. So if you have an incorrect ADP test and you don't figure it out a year or two later, the ADP refund route is out of time, out of luck, and then you got to make corrective contributions. And I've seen plans where, you know, the corrective contributions are in the tens of thousands of dollars, and that's not fun. And that is a serious error. And, you know, it's something to be avoided, but this is what happens. You know, obviously voluntary compliance is a great mechanism, but a lot of times plan sponsors aren't aware of their errors until there's a plan audit. IRS is going to give you the hammer. They'll have it corrected. They may give you a penalty, but you're in a far better situation if you know about the error ahead of time. I think this pilot program that they're doing, that are going to give plan sponsors 90 days to correct any issues before an audit, is something I hope that is permanent. It would certainly cut down on, you know, penalties and fines if it's corrected. And obviously, if they're not corrected before the audit, then the penalties probably will go up. That's the nature of the game. IRS DOL low voluntary compliance. You know, and if you don't go through voluntary compliance, they're going to give you the hammer. And the hammer is a certain high excise tax. So I hope you enjoyed this episode of that 401k podcast. Please tune in next week for another fun-filled episode. And of course, go to that 401ksite.com for further information on all our events, including Texas and New York. Thank you. Bye.